Chapter 40. Since early morning, the wind had blown steadily out of the northeast. By late afternoon, it had increased to a gale of 35 knots, which in turn threw up mountainous seas that pitched the salvage ships about like paper cups in a dishwasher. The tempest carried with it a numbing cold, born from the barren wastes above the Arctic Circle. The men dared not venture out onto the icy decks. It was no secret that the greatest barrier against keeping warm was the wind. A man could feel much colder and more miserable at 20 degrees above zero Fahrenheit with a 35-knot wind than at 20 degrees below zero with no wind. The wind steals the body heat as quickly as it can be manufactured, a nasty situation known as chill factor. Joel Farquhar, the Capricorn's weatherman, on loan from the Federal Meteorological Services Administration, seemed unconcerned with the storm snapping outside the operations room as he studied the instrumentation that tied into the National Weather Satellites and provided four space pictures of the North Atlantic every 24 hours. "What does your prognosticating little mind see for our future?" Fed asked, bracing his body against the roll. "She'll start easing in another hour," Farquhar replied. "By sunrise tomorrow, the wind should be down to 10 knots. Farquhar didn't look up when he spoke. He was a studious little red-faced man with utterly no sense of humor and no trace of friendly warmth. Yet he was respected by every man on the salvage operation because of his total dedication to the job and the fact that his predictions were uncannily accurate. "The best laid plans," Pip murmured idly to himself. "Another day lost. That's 4 times in 1 week we've had to cast off and buoy the airline." "Only God can make a storm," Farquhar said indifferently. He nodded toward the 2 banks of television monitors that covered the forward bulkhead of the Capricorn's operations room. "At least they're not bothered by it all." Pitt looked at the screens which showed the submersibles, calmly working on the wreck 12,000 feet below the relentless sea. Their independence from the surface was the saving grace of the project. With the exception of the sea slug, which only had a downtime of 18 hours and was now securely tied on the MODOK's deck, the other 3 submersibles could be scheduled to stay down on the Titanic for 5 days at a stretch before they returned to the surface to change crews. He turned to Al Giordino, who was bent over a large chart table. "What's the disposition of the surface ships?" Giordino pointed at the tiny 2-inch models scattered about the chart. "The Capricorn is holding her usual position in the center. The MODOK is dead ahead, and the Bomberger is trailing 3 miles astern." Pitt stared at the model of the Bomberger. She was a new vessel, constructed especially for deep water salvage. "Tell her captain to close up to within 1 mile." Giordino nodded toward the bald radio operator, who was moored securely to the slanting deck in front of his equipment. "You heard the man, Curly. Tell the Bomberger to come up to 1 mile astern." "How about the supply ships?" Pitt asked. "No problem there. This weather's duck soup to big 10-tonners the likes of these two. The Alhambra's in position to port, and the Monterey Park is right where she's supposed to be to starboard." Pitt nodded at a small red model. "I see our Russian friends are still with us." "The Mikhail Kurkov?" Giordino said. He picked up a blue replica of a warship and placed it next to the red model. "Yeah, but she can't be enjoying the game. The Juno, that Navy-guided missile cruiser, hangs on like glue." "And the wreck boy's signal unit?" "Serenely beeping away 80 feet beneath the uproar," Giordino announced. "Only 1,200 yards, give or take a hair, bearing 059, southwest, that is." "Thank God we haven't been blown off the homestead," Pitt sighed. "Relax," Giordino grinned reassuringly. "You act like a mother with a daughter out on a date after midnight every time there's a little breeze." "The mother-hen complex becomes worse the closer we get," Pitt admitted. 10 more days, Al. If we can get 10 calm days, we can wrap it up." "That's up to the weather oracle." Giordino turned to Farquhar. "What about it, O great seer of meteorological wisdom?" 12 hours advance notice is all you'll get out of me, Farquhar grunted without looking up. This is the North Atlantic. She's the most unpredictable of any ocean in the world. Hardly one day is ever the same. Now, if your precious Titanic had gone down in the Indian Ocean, I could give you your 10-day prediction with an 80% chance of accuracy. Excuses, excuses, Giardino replied. I bet when you make love to a woman, you tell her going in that there's a 40% chance she'll enjoy it. 40% is better than nothing, Farquhar said casually. Pitt caught a gesture by the sonar operator and moved over to him. What have you got? A strange pinging noise over the amplifier, the sonar man replied. He was a pale-faced man, about the size and shape of a gorilla. I've picked it up off and on during the last 2 months. Strange sort of sound. Kind of like somebody was sending messages. Make anything of it? No, sir. I had Curly listen to it, but he said it was pure gibberish. Most likely a loose object on the wreck that's being rattled about by the current. Or maybe it's a ghost, the sonar man said. You don't believe in them, but you're afraid of them. Is that it? 1,500 souls went down on the Titanic, the sonar man said. It's not unlikely that at least one came back to haunt the ship. The only spirits I'm interested in, Giardino said from the chart table, are the kind you drink. The interior cabin camera of the Sappho 2 just blacked out. This from the sandy-haired man seated at the TV monitor. Pitt was immediately behind him, staring at the blackened monitor. Is the problem at this end? No, sir. All circuits here and on the buoy's relay panel are operable. The problem must be on the Sappho 2. It just seemed like somebody hung a cloth over the camera lens. Pitt swung to face the radio operator. Curly, contact Sappho 2 and ask them to check their cabin TV camera. Giardino picked up a clipboard and checked the crew schedule. Omar Woodson is in command of the Sappho 2 this shift. Curly pressed the transmit switch. Sappho 2? Hello, Sappho 2. This is Capricorn. Please reply. Then he leaned forward, pressing his headset tighter to his ears. The contact is weak, sir. Lots of interference. The words are very broken. I can't make them out. Turn on the speaker, Pitt ordered. A voice rattled into the operations room, muffled behind a wave of static. Something's jamming the transmission, said Curly. The relay unit on the airline buoy should be picking them up loud and clear. Give your volume everything it's got. Maybe we can make some sense out of Woodson's reply. Sappho 2, could you repeat, please? We cannot read you. Over. As soon as Curly turned up the speaker, the explosion of ear-splitting crackle made everyone jump.
Corn, we, Lear, Ver.
Pitt grabbed the microphone. Omar, this is Pitt. Your cabin TV camera is out. Can you repair? We will await your reply. Over. Every eye in the operations room locked on the speaker as though it were alive. 5 interminable minutes dragged by while they patiently waited for Woodson's report. Then Woodson's fragmented voice hammered through the loudspeaker again.
Hen, Monk, S, Per, On, Sir.
Giardino twisted his face, puzzled. Something about Henry Monk. The rest is too garbled to comprehend.
They're back on monitor.
Not every eye had been aimed at the speaker. The young man at the TV monitors had never taken his off Sappho 2's screen. The crew looks like they're grouped around someone lying on the deck. Like spectators at a tennis match, every head turned in unison to the TV monitor. Figures were moving to and fro in front of the camera, while in the background, 3 men could be seen bent over a body stretched grotesquely on the submersible's narrow cabin deck.
Omar, listen to me, Pitt snapped into the microphone. We do not understand your transmissions. You are back on TV monitor. I repeat, you are back on TV monitor. Write your message and hold it up to the camera. Over.
They watched one of the figures detach itself from the rest and lean over a table for a few moments, writing, and then approach the TV camera.
It was Woodson. He held up a scrap of paper whose rough printing read, "Henry Monk dead. Request permission to surface."
"Good God!"
Giordino's expression was one of pure astonishment.
"Henry Monk dead? It can't be true."
"Omar Woodson isn't noted for playing games," Pitt said grimly. He began to transmit again. "Negative, Omar. You cannot surface. There's a 35-knot gale up here. The sea is turbulent. I repeat, you cannot surface." Woodson nodded that he understood. Then he wrote something else, looking over his shoulder furtively every so often. The note said, "I suspect Monk murdered." Even Farquhar's usually inscrutable face had gone pale.
"You'll have to let them surface now," he whispered.
"I will do what I have to do." Pitt shook his head decisively. "My feelings will have to look elsewhere. There are 5 men still alive and breathing inside Sappho 2. I won't risk bringing them up, only to lose them all under a 30-foot wave. No, gentlemen, we will just have to sit it out until sunrise to see what there is to see inside the Sappho 2.